in the meditation this evening, we focused on available in relation to being able to relate to what arises in our lives through our body, through our emotions and thoughts, and through our very aliveness itself. And so our reflection this evening is going to be in regard to that relatedness and to contemplate. We are first contemplating relatedness, and then we're doing inquiry in terms of our own relatedness with it. But first, this general contemplation. Contemplation is like opening to and getting into the territory of and noticing its contours if you're walking on a hike or something. And then the inquiry is, well, what's really going on here, and the plants here and the birds and so forth. It's like that in our own experience, this contemplation and inquiry, both very useful. Sometimes we don't have the time for inquiry, but we can at least do a small amount of contemplation. So here in the first of the year, we are reflecting, as has been a tradition of how many, many years. I don't know if Marin Sangha is this 23 years or something of our having that I start the first of our year together in Marin Sangha with this kind of a reflection. And as always, I mentioned that the solstice has passed, that we have gone past the darkest day of the year in this kind of a limited activity in the light activity, a natural light activity. And we are in this time that is associated with the god Janus of the Roman god, where a face forward and a face backwards. And it's referred to as being at the threshold. We're looking into this new year, but we're still connected to the past year. So we can feel both. We're an in-between that allows us to contemplate, however modestly to contemplate, how we wish to relate. What is our, not just our resolutions we want as goals, but what is our aspiration? What is the ground in which we are going to stand in this year of living our lives, day by day, hour by hour, moment by moment? Where are we standing? What is the relatedness? In what way are we being available? How much does it matter, this feeling of available to you? How much does it matter that you be aligned in living your days, in living your hours, living your moments? How much? What is the aspiration? What, you're here in between. This year, I'm not going to pay any attention to this. I'm just going to go live my life. Choice, fine. Or, no, I wish to be in an active relationship with life so that I have choice as to how I relate to the various experience in the various facets of my life. That this is something I care about, that I wish to cultivate, that I wish to have more capacity, because it seems wholesome to do so. And in doing that, it allows for skillful means in terms of how I meet the moment. Skillful means in relation to what? And the Buddhist view of skillful means for being able to choose the path, the moment, the response of a word or an action that involves choosing non-suffering over suffering. The Buddha is very clear about this over and over again. And the Buddha is most clear in the very first turning of the wheel, which is the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, which has been my area of deepest study, deepest practice for the last, I guess, 17 years or something. I've sort of lost track. And so we are in this first turning of the wheel, we are looking at it tonight from the point of view of relatedness. The first turning of the wheel is the Four Noble Truths, the first of being that there is dukkha, that there is a kind of tension, an unsatisfactoriness, some say stress, some say suffering, all these different translations and many more words, to life. I call it that it's the realm of the opposites, this realm in which we live. So there's pain and pleasure, gain and loss. These are the Buddha's words. He calls them the eight worldly winds, but we can go more and more, many more opposites there. Life and death is an opposite. And that's the nature of the realm in which we live. And the Buddha is saying that, you know, if you wish to be alive in a way that has choice, then you have to be willing to stand under, be available for, knowing the dukkha, living the dukkha. And the opposites include sukha. There is the unsatisfactoriness, the tensions in there, the moments of relaxation and joy and so forth. So it's a dance of this dukkha-sukha. And because it's ever-changing, the sukha itself has no permanent satisfaction because it changes. So we don't rely on the sukha as our shelter, but rather in how we relate to the dukkha-sukha. Does that make sense to you? In your life, it's easy to see. Whatever your story of your life is, it's there in every story of every life. And so we may not have in the past thought about it, about relating, but it makes lots of sense. In Dancing with Life, I did not have the confidence to draw this out the way I'm now drawing this out in terms of relatedness. It took every bit of confidence I have to do that book just as I did it. But lots of things I would change now. I have a little more confidence. In this relatedness this way, that, okay, I want to be able to stand under dukkha, knowing of dukkha. And that is the very practice, and that's the 12 insight practice of the Four Noble Truths as described in the Samyutta Nikaya. The practice part, the second insight of the First Noble Truth, is that one is to know, to penetrate the truth of dukkha, to stand under it, to feel the ouch of it. And then how do you relate to that ouch? It does hurt. This is one of the great confusions that I did not personally have to deal with, but I was sort of surprised that so many people either implicitly or directly expect that, well, if I'm a good Buddhist, I'm not gonna feel the ouch of dukkha. But the Buddha did. When we have a body, we're going to feel dukkha. When we have people we care about in any way, we will feel their suffering. That's a motivation. That's the heart's response. The Brahmaviharas reflect that. So we're not trying to numb ourselves or avoid the dukkha, be tuned out from it, but rather to be tuned in a related way. And the second noble truth is that the Buddha teaches that it's the dukkha is, you know, just the nature of this realm. There's no reason to be all upset about it. That's the price to pay. It's the price to get on the bus. But the problem is that we get very upset about it, and we want it to be otherwise. And therefore, we have a clinging, grasping relationship. It's a reactive, not a responsive, but a reactive relationship to the experiences of our life. And so our relatedness is a grasping, a contracting, a wanting otherwise. And he iterates these three different ways. That's true. And it seems natural enough to do this because we want all of our sensate experiences to be pleasant, at least to be neutral. That's not crazy. That's not grasping in itself. But when we are reactive about it, when when we're meeting life with this kind of hidden demand or outward demand, this grasping, this collapsing into, he called it shooting ourselves with the second arrow. Dukkha being an arrow that penetrates us, that the second arrow is our reactive mind. So our relating to it makes our suffering worse, makes us clumsy, causes our suffering that we're experiencing to be reactive in a way that causes other people's suffering, just as other people's suffering, other people's dukkha is causing us suffering. And it's just this endless cycle of that, endless cycle of the reactive minds going together, grasping, clinging, demanding, wanting things to be a certain way, and a sensation-wise and all the senses, wanting to become that which we're not, that we aspire towards, that we're really grasping after, because we don't want to, we don't like it the way it is in some way, and then not wanting to be where we are, not enjoying it, not wanting to be the way that we are, that we view as a not good, not desirable. And that's the form of relatedness that leads to the second arrow, to the suffering of that. And so, in this time of the beginning of a year, how are we going to do that? We know many ways that we fall into our reactivity. We could all create a top 10 list, couldn't we, of our reactive minds? You know, maybe it's your physical body. Maybe it's something mental. Maybe it's something from the past that you just can't stop grasping. When in relation to the past, when we stop grasping, it doesn't mean that those feelings about the past, those images, those energies in the body about it go away automatically. It means that we cease to be fighting them, going against them. They were porous to them, so they come and go like fear. When we open to fear as just being fear that's arising and passing, fear is much more manageable when we're in, oh, I can't be in this fear, or we believe that fear is all that's happening. So we start to have more choice. And choice is critical to the Buddha's teaching. Choice to choose non-suffering over suffering. If that's not possible, then the teachings collapse. It's an orientation to choosing. It's not a full empowerment of choice. That's directionally where we're going. But in this moment, it is a bowing as best I am able. May I choose non-suffering in this moment. To the degree that I understand it, to the degree that my reactivity allows me to have choice. So there's the initial stimulation, which can cause a lot of reactivity. And then there's the second relationship, which is either responsive or reactive. And that's the teaching. And here in the start of the year, I kind of know that already. You might be able to say to yourself, yeah, I've thought about this many times. I've heard all this, and I've said it to my friends even, said it to myself. Is there a degree standing here in between the past and the future that you can drop in another level of that, that you can have a practice that is street of life practice about this, that you can lovingly give yourself this empowerment, just a little bit, just opening to it. So let's pause for a moment here and just, does this all make any sense to you? Just, this is the contemplation. We pause to catch up with ourselves. This is a time of pausing, of catching up with ourselves. Boy, I can think of this area or that area, whatever it may be. I can certainly think of my own area where I get pulled into reactivity. It may be for you personal. It may be for you about concerns about our planet where you get so reactive. And you go, but I care about the planet. I should care about saving our planet. Absolutely. But your reactivity is not empowering to you based on my own experience of reactivity. The love, the caring is very empowering, but the reactive is divisive in a way that creates a tension in us that wears us out. In all aspects, even with compassion, you've heard about compassion fatigue, because it's so reactive, we start burning ourselves out. It may be political for you. It may be worrying about your own financial, or it's worrying about your children, or the love of your life, or your loneliness, or whatever it may be that you get reactive about. Is there a possibility of a more spacious relationship around what have these areas of our reactivity? More spacious is filling with more choice, but boy, looking at how this causes suffering in me, not judging it, not as a judgment, but as a recognition, a discernment. Look at how one thought builds another here. Watch how something starts feeding in me on it. It goes on and on. I'm somehow being caught in it in a way that's actually the stimulation is part of what's hooking me. I don't want to be stimulated this way. It's bad enough, this condition with my body or this situation with my family member. I don't want to have more suffering, more reactivity around it if I have any choice. Then therefore you inquire, do I have choice? Is there a possibility of choice? Can I hold this questioning of, is there a choice? Is there a possibility of choice? May I have choice in how I relate to this difficulty? May I have choice? Knowing choice, mindful choice, in context. When we start to have more of this kind of interest, we can be at the moment of our being stimulated, like here and hearing a Dharma talk, listening to a Dharma talk, reading whatever you do in terms of your Dharma investigation. We can be stimulated, but we can't carry it on to our lives. And I've asked myself many times, why is this? And the thing that I noticed repeatedly is because we are so lodged in the idea of things. And the idea of things is great. They really can stimulate us, inspire us and all. But it's actually the felt sense of things. It's the here and now of the felt sense of feeling in the reactivity where you're causing yourself further suffering, or you're causing others suffering, others to suffer, or you causing yourself and others to suffer, that you the felt sense of that, the recognition through the felt sense that in my experience is where we start to have choice, because we don't want to feel that anymore. We just get tired of it. We just don't want to do it. Or we feel like, there's a little glimmer of possibility here, and I can feel that little glimmer of possibility. That's here now, in its nature. And that carries us forward. And I'm fully aware of how much the Buddha's ideas have been so important to people. But as I read the suttas, so much of the actual suttas are pointing to felt sense experience. Suffering as felt suffering. Clinging as a felt experience of suffering. The body is a felt sense experience. Knowing the body and the body is not like an encyclopedic description of the body, but rather a felt sense of posture. How would you know posture except as a felt sense? A felt sense of the parts of a body. How else would you know the parts of the body except through felt sense? It's a real knowing. And the same with sensations. And the same with the elements. It's a felt sense experience as being described to us. And then through that felt sense, how are we relating in a felt sense way? So this body alone can be such a teacher for us. This first of the four Satipatthanas can, in the course of this year that we're now starting, can be so powerful, just an embodied experience of this year, saying right now, I want to stay embodied. I want to have a felt sense of my relatedness. So when I'm standing getting coffee, I want to be there in an embodied way that I can feel when I contract. And I start to be a little snarky to the person who's taking my order and recognize, why am I being snarky to this person? You know, they're having their day and I don't have to get involved in that. I don't have to be offended. I'm going to expect better service. They're just having their day. I get to have my day. What is the felt sense of when I don't get caught up in someone else's dukkha in a reactive way? What choice do I have to be kind rather than snarky? And I don't mean this as a concept. I mean here and now, there in the coffee line. Here and now is the teaching in this way. One thing that really helps this is the inward staying possibility. That first part of what I call the preparatory practice, this arriving sequence. When we arrive, we are coming into mindfulness. We're coming into the present moment. You don't need me to be able to do this practice. If you've been exposed to it once, and many of you have been exposed to it many times from me and others now, the whole, as most of many of you know, there's a new Dharma community called Dharma Ground that's utilizing all of these practices. And there's lots of talks that are recorded there, lots of different programs you can do. So far as you need to be in community with this, that's a great community for that purpose. But to arrive in this moment, that your orientation on the street, not in coming back for another kind of a dose of it, but that you're going to take whatever doses you get when you're in Sangha and go live them as practice. You go live them as practice, and that your monastery becomes the street of your life, your life experiences, because you can't be on a retreat center all the time. And so this is why you would come to that. This is why you would come to this kind of view about this. And then this the being available again is a very felt sense. You arrive, you're in mindfulness, just the way I described it. You could feel the immediacy of the moment, and you feel present. And this recognition, I just did a retreat in December, late November, on recognition. Recognition is so often not really investigated enough to be really empowered by what the Buddha is offering. But you recognize that you are present, and you recognize this embodied awareness that we colloquially refer to as presence. You all feel it, but do you recognize it? That's the question here in the in-between, between the past and the future, standing here, inquiring. And then the aligning is the aligning with the Buddhist principles as taught by the Buddha. And maybe for you, you're not that committed, so you align to Buddhism that way, but you align with love itself or living from your deepest values. But you are deliberately aligning as a skillful means. So this aligning and available is a very specific way. It's very, the wholesomeness of it, it's the motivation is wholesome, and the felt sense of it as of a skillful means that gets us in touch with ourselves. And we can do this driving our cars when we're getting upset about traffic. We can shift the view to this inner experience. I'm quite serious about this. It's not idealistic. It's very practical. It takes practice. It takes practice. If we're going to live the Dhamma, from my point of view, what we're doing is practicing practice. You're practicing practice. I certainly am practicing practice. I seldom lose touch with that after all of these years. So this available and aligned creates this inward staying. In your morning practice, you can establish yourself in an inner staying way. All this stuff's arising in the mind, but you're not so interested in that. You're just interested in the felt sense of the state of your mind heart. You're cultivating it, and you're not letting the experiences. Your body could be hurting. You could be excited about what you're going to do when you leave your meditation, but you keep your attention on this available aligned in this way. That is establishing a new capacity of your being able to relate rather than react. Maybe this isn't useful to you. Then what would be useful to you in a way that you meet life? Here, in between, when you're not doing something else, you contemplate, you inquire, what is a skillful way for me to have less suffering in my life? Very modest, very, very modest, very, very modest. A little bit of change, a little bit of more directed attention, which is what we're doing in this practice, can make such a large difference. You have to live it to see for yourself. There's no way that I could convince you. So then said another way, we're moving from a reactive mind to a responsive mind. A reactive mind gets defined by what's happened to us in this moment in our mind heart. We're defined by it. So we will lash out, or we'll contract, or we won't really see what's in front of us because we're blinded by our reactivity. We don't see what's really going on. We are deluded. The mind isn't in a tangle. We're defined by it. And then a responsive mind, same degree of stimulation and same degree of unpleasant or pleasant, because both of us can delude us. Both sides of pleasant and unpleasant can delude us and lead to suffering. That's one of the ironies of this, is that if we don't have a wise relationship with sukha, then we add to our suffering all over again. Very ironic. Sort of the joke in a way of life, if you want to. Many cynical philosophers have pointed that out in non-Buddhist terms. But in a responsive mind, the same degree of discomfort, but we are in a relationship to that discomfort does not define us, but characterizes. This moment is characterized by that person at the coffee, who's getting your coffee for you, being snarky. You get defined by that, and you give up choice if you're reactive. But if you're responsive, you see their suffering, and you see your choices. When we are defined, we have very little choice. But when we're simply characterized by the moment, much more choice. So much part of the Zen teachings too, but I won't go off on that at this point. So that's the reflection. If anybody wants to make a comment about this or anything to say, this is a moment for it. If anyone wants wants to do this. Yes, Shannon. So, Bill, you have to release.
There. Thank you so much. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
So that, you know, you're characterized and defined. Can you give me an example in a life situation between those two?
Well,
I know you just said about the coffee shop.
So the person you're really close to, whom you were really looking forward to seeing or something, and they hurt your feelings. And you get so reactive. Once again, they've hurt my feelings, you know. And now you're on your narrative, your loop of dependent origination of, they're like this, da, 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 da. And you've been defined by it. You've been defined by it. You have your whatever love you have for that person is not available in that moment. You're defined by a reactivity that doesn't have room for compassion, for willing. This person can be irritating and I love her. It gets lost. You don't have that choice. So that's an easy example in our personal life. We can be in political differences, and in our political differences, we literally dehumanize the other in our reactivity. That doesn't seem to work out very well for parties that are in that kind of a thing, or societies that are divided in that absolute way. And ourselves, we can disappoint ourselves. And once again, we couldn't do this. Whatever it is. And we're so reactive to that, our frustration with this, our continual disappointment, and we're swept away by it. And you're defined. There's no compassion for yourself.
Can you give the characterized by it instead, example?
So the same feeling happens where you're so upset with yourself, and because you've cultivated this attitude of responsiveness, you're available and aligned. You go, oh boy, this catches me every time. Oh boy, I'm so caught. I just feel this like all through my guts, you know, and my heart's like stone. But you're in relation to that guts tightened and that like stone, and you have compassion. There's room for compassion. The recognition, that's the recognition of the dukkha, you see. And then you switch that second noble truth. You're not relating. The instruction of the second noble truth is to let loose of the grasping. In that moment of relating, you're letting loose of the grasping. It's very measurable. It's very practical. And if it wasn't that way, how in the world could people in the Buddhist time understood it? They didn't have all this complex self. There was not that complexion of a self that we've established over, you know, all these hundreds and hundreds of years. That so burdens us.
So thank you
for the question.